This episode of the MGMA podcast is brought to you by Walmart Business. It's the Walmart you love, now for business. Get everything you need for your staff and patients in one place. Enjoy big savings on health and safety products, cleaning supplies, over-the-counter medications, and much more. And don't forget the break room snacks. Create a free account today and start shopping at business.walmart.com. That's business.walmart.com. Introducing First Call Triage, your ultimate remote medical staffing solution. With their office hours nurse triage line, front office services, including appointment scheduling and insurance verification, and back office services, managing medication refills and prior authorizations, First Call Triage can streamline your practice's operations. Plus, their remote patient monitoring and chronic care management ensure comprehensive patient care. So make the right call. First Call Triage is the first and only call you need for efficient, cost-effective, and high-quality medical staffing. So visit their website at firstcalltriage.com to revolutionize your practice. Again, that's firstcalltriage.com. Well, hi, everyone. This is Daniel Williams, senior editor at MGMA and host of the MGMA Podcast Network. Glad to have a repeat guest today. It's Dr. Alex Ding. He's Associate Vice President of Physician Strategy and Medical Affairs at Humana. And Dr. Ding is, along with many of his Humana colleagues, have been working on the 2023 Value-Based Care Report. And the exciting thing here, in addition to that, is it's the 10th anniversary of this annual research, and looking forward to hearing what Dr. Ding has to say about it. So at this point, welcome to the show.
Daniel, thank you so much for the opportunity to be back on the podcast. I really enjoyed it the last time. Thrilled to be here with you again. So thank you to you, the MGMA, and to your listeners.
That is great. And welcome back here. So we did, as I was saying, have you on the show last year to talk about that annual research on value-based care. Over the past 10 years, Humana's value-based care reports have been explaining and researching what's going on in value-based care. So I just wanted you to have an opportunity, since it is the 10th anniversary of this. What are some of the biggest successes in advancing value-based care that we've seen over these past 10 years? What's going on out there?
Yeah, over the past 10 years, there's been a continual evolution and adoption of value-based care. In particular, we have a growing body of evidence that shows that value-based care is able to help us push for improvements in all of the components in the triple aim in healthcare, that is quality, experience, and cost. And no doubt, many of your listeners already know that quality plus experience over cost is how we define value. So this year's report shows that 70% of our individual Medicare Advantage members are seen by PCPs in value-based care arrangements, the highest in our history and amongst some of the highest in the industry. We've seen tremendous growth over the last 10 years since publishing these reports. We've gotten 2.3 million members into value-based care arrangements in that 10-year period. And you know, I mentioned the triple aim in healthcare as what all of us in healthcare continue to strive toward. And we've seen that value-based care makes it such that we can improve in each of these areas rather than having to sacrifice in one to improve in the others. So in the area of quality, we see preventative screenings are up. Both HEDIS and patient safety ratings are higher for value-based care compared with non-value-based care. We know better patient experience with higher CAHPS scores and STAR scores for members in value-based care compared with non-value-based care. And we see that there's less low-value care with 30% fewer unnecessary hospitalizations compared with fee-for-service original Medicare. We also see patients get more visits with their PCP, which results in fewer inpatient days, fewer unnecessary ED visits, all the while saving the system money. About 23% lower costs compared with fee-for-service original Medicare, which we can then reinvest these savings into other wraparound services and opportunities to address things like health-related social needs and also to reduce the member premiums.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. I've been working on this several years with Humana, either from early communication with y'all about some of that research to now the last 2 years having you on the podcast as well. And it's been really exciting seeing how this has been evolving. So let's talk about that from the clinical operating model side of it. How have things evolved over the last 10 years? What are you seeing out there?
I think it's taken time for value-based care to grow and evolve, and it's taken time for it to evolve into a clinical model. And I would say it first started off as a contracting and financial model, then got translated into a more generalized operating model. And then finally, I feel like it's getting to the point where it's really integrated into being a true clinical model. And so based on that evolution, when we first started our engagement in value-based care, it was with CFOs and COOs of provider organizations. But we know that where it truly matters is what it means to the patient, their experience with the healthcare system, their quality of life, and their health outcomes. And so we've really been trying to change the focus on how we talk about value-based care in terms of what does it actually feel like? What does it actually look like at the clinic level, both for the patient and also for the clinician as well? And so these clinical models have seen some significant changes in trying to adopt a value-based care with changes in clinical workflow, clinician resources, the need to develop new skill sets, such as managing patients with a team-based approach, population and panel management, in addition to being able to take care of each individual patient. And really, I think even broader than that, a cultural shift from episodic care managing acute illness into one that is more preventative, more holistic, more supportive, chronic care management and managing and sustaining of health rather than just taking care of acute illness. And so at a fundamental level, you know, that means a focus on quality of care, patient experience over the quantity of care. That results in deeper patient engagement and strengthened patient-physician relationships. And so at the clinical level, we see smaller panels. Patients get more frequent and longer visits with their PCPs. They get higher touch care. There's more integrated care with more staffing resources like dietitians, behavioral health professionals, care coaches, social workers as kind of part of the overall care team. We see more care outside the clinic walls, including virtual care, remote monitoring. You have care management, disease management programs that provide care and manage care between clinic visits.
Yeah, you already answered a lot of the next question I was going to ask you about how it's positively impacting the experience of patients receiving care. So I'll reframe it just a little bit. Do you have maybe a specific example? Is there anything where you can point to where those patients receiving care are really seeing the benefit of these value-based care models?
Yeah, that's a great question. I've got two examples, but you know, I just want to kind of touch on that cultural change a little bit more.
Right.
You know, in value-based care models, the system is a fundamental redesign in the incentives of the healthcare system, in that we flip the model from being a sick care model that's incentivized to take care of you when you're acutely sick into one that is a health model that's incentivized to help you live your best health to prevent sickness from either starting or progressing. And so certainly there's roles for both of these within our larger healthcare system, but I do think value-based care, particularly at the primary care level, just makes a lot of sense. And so, you know, I think, you know, if I talked about the various different ways in which it can increase that patient-physician relationship and how there's enablement of entire care teams that provide high-touch care. And so if you really translate that kind of more clinical language into consumer-centric language instead, you know, what is that? To me, it's excellent bespoke customer service. And so just a couple of examples for how we're seeing patients getting better experience, better care. So value-based care models focus more on prevention and lifestyle changes to improving health. So, you know, not only do patients prefer to stay healthy rather than just getting taken care of when they're sick, and certainly you could argue that it's easier to pop a pill or get a procedure done when you're sick, and that lifestyle changes are hard work. You know, there's absolutely no doubt about that. But
right.
Whereas in fee-for-service, You get maybe a 10, 15 minute visit with your doctor where as a parting throwaway comment from your hairy doc and tell you, oh, and you need to get some exercise and eat right.
Yeah.
As they're walking out the door. In value-based care, you may actually get a lot more support. You may have a dedicated coach and a dietitian to actually hold your hand and help set the right goals and know in a very practical and concrete way how to put a plan in place to make those lifestyle changes. The yeah. second example I would give is on the improved care coordination piece of it. And I think one of the major challenges of our US healthcare system is fragmentation. This results in a lot of things falling between the cracks, which can result in bad outcomes like poor transitions of care from hospitalization back home, which unfortunately might result in rehospitalization. And so in fee-for-service, while your doctor certainly cares about you, I think there's just not the infrastructure put in place to know when things outside the clinic may have happened, like an ED visit or a hospitalization. And in value-based care, there's every incentive for the practice to help coordinate transitions in care and care across the various different providers that you see. And so, you know, the last thing you want to do and get frustrated with as a sick patient is to sit on the phone, to ask for a fax about your hospital stay, and then sit on hold to get to talk to your PCP or to get in to see them in the next 3 weeks. And instead, in value-based care, that's your PCP's job and their office to deal with that. And frankly, they get rewarded and compensated for that important but often unrecognized work.
Yeah, I love that. Well, thank you for sharing that. So you've been providing a lot of the successes that have been taking place. So after 10 years in this study, where are you seeing the room for further expanding value-based care arrangements to even more providers, to even more healthcare sectors? Where's the growth?
Yeah, I actually think the best way for us to expand value-based care at this time isn't necessarily to expand into more provider types or healthcare systems, although I think in the near future, that is certainly something for us to keep top of mind. You know, I think now that we've got many places on the maturing side of the operating and the clinical model of value-based care, what we really should be doing is expanding the payers and the payment models to open up opportunities to get those practices more members so that they can really build scale and accelerate moving their entire panel of patients, not just their Medicare Advantage subset of patients, into value-based care practice. And, you know, because of the way in which Medicare Advantage is structured, there is greater flexibility and opportunity in these alternative payment models that have really enabled value-based care to grow in this line of insurance. But, you know, I've seen the model been proven out in Medicare Advantage, and as the models have matured, other insurance lines of business, you know, whether you want to talk about Medicaid or commercial insurance, they really should be leveraging those built-out value-based infrastructures to allow for greater penetration of members and patients into these value-based care settings. And we are seeing evidence that, you know, within the same value-based framework that we've built out and studied in Medicare Advantage, there are similar positive trajectories that can be expected when value-based care is applied to Medicaid, for example. Just as kind of one data point that we mentioned in our report, members in our Florida Medicaid plan are using less low value care in the order of about 10% fewer unnecessary ED visits when compared with those in non-value-based care arrangements.
Wow. Okay. Now, this next question I have for you, this I'm not sure how you want to address it, but let's look even more out into the future. Like, even you've been doing this study for 10 years. Maybe you and the team at Humana have done this, but if you've mapped out the next 10 years out, what do you see happening? What's promising? We've seen so much transformation in healthcare in this post-pandemic era. There's just so much transformation and innovation that's been taking place. So in the world of value-based care, what's 10 years from now look like?
You know, I think you alluded to this in your last question about how we further expand to more providers and healthcare sectors. And I think that is exactly right when we think about the future. You know, some of the areas that we're looking forward to and how we apply the same learnings from value-based care from the past 10 years into the next 10 years include places like specialty care and home health. And I mentioned that we've got good data and evidence from the last 10 years that value-based care can really improve in all three areas of the triple aim in healthcare. But I also know that your listeners know that over time, those three aims have also evolved into the quadruple aim, which focuses on a new aim on clinician experience and professional satisfaction. That's continued to evolve into a fifth aim with the quintuple aim, which also tackles health disparities and moves us toward more health equity. And I think those additional aims are those areas where we can see how value-based care models can make an impact in the next 10 years. You know, we have some early data that shows in some of each of these areas, you know, we have data that shows value-based care can help physicians and their practices do better financially. So in value-based care, we see that they see 16 cents of the overall healthcare dollar compared with only 6.5 cents for non-value-based care clinicians. And overall, we see our value-based care clinicians earn about 3.5 times the Medicare physician fee schedule, and those in more advanced states of the risk continuum earn 6 times the fee schedule. And I think given the epidemic of clinician burnout in this country, we're really looking forward to better understanding how value-based clinical models can reduce burnout and improve professional satisfaction. I mean, you can just imagine that having more time with your patients, being able to develop a stronger therapeutic relationship, having a whole team to help offload some of that responsibility would really be a satisfier for our clinicians, really allows them to focus on what they went into healthcare for, rather than being exhausted on the RVU hamster wheel. Yeah. You know, with regard to health equity, we also published a piece in the New England Journal of Medicine Catalyst on health equity measures, which showed that patients had higher engagement rates with their healthcare amongst value-based care compared with fee-for-service within each ethnicity group, and that there's also less disparity amongst ethnicity groups in value-based care compared with fee-for-service.
Wow. Okay. So the next question I have for you is, if there are providers out there who maybe aren't fully invested in value-based care or still thinking about adopting some of these value-based care approaches, what advice would you give them? What are some first steps to get more integrated and integrating value-based care more into their practice?
You know, I think that value-based care as a concept and in principle is something that most providers are on board with. However, it's once you delve in a little bit deeper than just this buzz phrase that you realize that there are a lot of questions in terms of how does this actually work in practice? And what are the things that you need to do to restructure your practice from soup to nuts to actually practice in this different way? And that deeper level of understanding can really be pretty daunting to a practice to first understand and even more so to implement. So at a very fundamental level, we want providers to better understand truly what does practicing in value-based care feel and look like? What does that workflow look like? We've developed a course with the University of Houston that is available on Coursera that focuses on the fundamentals of value-based care, not only gives an understanding of the high-level principles, but also gives a framework and a skill set to think about how to implement that into your practices one small step at a time. I would say another step would be to talk to your payers, to speak with their value-based care contracting teams. Oftentimes, they've got resources to assess how ready your practice is for value-based care practice. They'll often work with you on how to take those baby steps to putting the financial arrangement into practice. This often means, you know, more connectivity and partnership with them, including greater sharing of data and access to population health management analytics and tools, something, for example, that our Humana value-based contracting teams provide. We've got a few links at the end of our value-based care report as well that could take you right into the next step, regardless of whether or not you're currently working with us or not. And then there are a number of established organizations like Agilon and Aledade that really can help with the implementation and the practice of value-based care. And they work with small groups and practices who may not have the expertise or the resources to go it alone.
All right. Well, with that said, then, what are some of the existing challenges or barriers to wider adoption of value-based care models?
Yeah, I think it would be disingenuous to say that value-based care is the panacea to all of healthcare's problems. So why isn't everyone doing it right now? I think we need to recognize that such a fundamental shift in how we structure and work in healthcare means moving from a fee-for-service model that's been in existence for 100 plus years. And this is a fundamental restructuring of healthcare from top to bottom. It takes time, it takes patience, it takes investment to make such a big change. And so right now, many practices are still living and working in a system with what I call one foot in each canoe. That is, some of their reimbursement is fee for service, some of their reimbursement is value-based care. And to operate in two very different incentive models, I think is just incredibly challenging. So as a practicing physician, I know that how I practice and treat a patient does not change with what insurance they have, and certainly not whether or not they're in an insurance contract that's fee for service or global risk. In fact, you know, I don't even know what insurance they have, and quite frankly, it doesn't matter. But how those incentive structures and how the system is built can be very confusing when you've got one foot in each canoe. And let me just give an example. You can just think of differences in compensation structures for physicians in each system. So in a fee-for-service model, there's the drive for volume. Compensation is often RVU-driven. Bonuses are tied to how many patients can you crank through in a day. And so that's how you influence physician behavior for productivity. In a value-based care model, the compensation structure should be structured to reward quality and health outcomes. You know, that should mean there's incentives to take more time with patients. You no longer have to feel like you've got this hamster wheel to run on. But there's also greater accountability and responsibility for more holistic care and wraparound services. But what I see time and time again is that compensation structures for clinicians in value-based care models are still RVU-based. And that really creates the wrong incentive. I would say also disengaging for the physician as well, because their incentives go contrary to the system's incentives. And so if you've got some of your contracts in fee-for-service and some in value-based care, now, how do you really design a system that kind of makes sense in both? And I would say it is very hard. And so oftentimes what we see is, you know, as a practice is becoming more and more value-based care, their infrastructure and their chassis is still built on fee-for-service. And so, you know, I think that big barrier is, what is that right kind of chassis that allows maybe more hybrid practice or as transitional as you move further along that continuum. And I think that is probably one of the biggest barriers I hear time and time again.
Yeah, thank you for that. So we've got time for one more question. So final question, and I just want to get a better idea of how organizations like Humana can continue to support and advance this shift to value-based care arrangements. What advice can you give to us?
Yeah, I think this really requires a multifaceted approach. So, you know, at a high level, we've been working on research, data, evidence showing what can be achieved with value-based care, which is one reason why we're so excited to publish our now 10th annual value-based care report. You know, there's a big getting the word out piece of it. There's digging in deeper to help people understand what value-based care is, how it's practiced, and moving from it just being an industry buzzword. There's also an advocacy component to it, working with legislators and regulators to figure out, how do you shape policy to create more flexibility, more incentives for the enablement of value-based care, something that we've seen done well in Medicare Advantage, but would like to see across other sorts of plan products and insurance lines. But I think most helpful is tactically working with practices directly and partnering to help them get there. I would say a lot of that happens at the contracting level. And so we work to understand where they are in their readiness for adoption, where along that value continuum they're ready for. We don't necessarily want them to just jump into the deep end without first using those floaties or first going in the shallow end. We kind of want to meet them where they are and help them figure out what they need to do to get to where they want to be. Our goal is not to push everyone into the deep end toward global risk, but really to where in that value-based care continuum they want to end up, and to do it in collaboration. And a lot of that support is at the operational level. So we help create partnerships with organizations that really help practices enable value-based care. As I mentioned, like the Agilons and the Allidades of the world. We also help with implementation of data and analytics infrastructure that's needed for the data sharing that's needed to enable population health management. Just as an example, we have a free tool called Compass that we provide our partner practices. We've also partnered with EHR vendors for improved interoperability to allow some of that greater free flow of data. And we put on a forum every year that brings together Humana executives with practices that are either in global risk or moving along that value-based care continuum to gather, share best practices and learnings, and to really create a community that's all working on this transition together.
That is awesome. Well, thank you so much, Dr. Ding, for joining us again on the MGMA podcast.
Thank you so much, Daniel.
All right. Well, that is going to do it for this episode of the MGMA Business Solutions podcast. Again, we've been joined by Dr. Alex Ding of Humana, and we've been discussing the 10th year of the annual Humana Value-Based Care Report. There were a lot of great resources that Dr. Ding shared with us today, so I'm going to be sure and put those direct links into the episode show notes so you can directly access those. So until then, thanks for being an MGMA podcast listener. The popular buzzword we've been seeing everywhere is AI. But what we all want to know is how we can implement and use it to our advantage when it comes to improving margins, accelerating cash flow, and optimizing staff performance. There's a one-stop shop using cloud-based predictive analytics. MGMA Analytics is your AI-enabled tool that upscales technology you've already been paying for, so you can silo your disparate systems and make data-backed business decisions. Visit mgma.com/analytics and see how AI can revolutionize your finances and operations. Again, visit mgma.com/analytics today.